My name is Stephen Dubner. This is Freakonomics Radio, and this is the second part of a series we're calling Bad Medicine. It's about the many ways in which the medical establishment, for all the obvious good they've done in the world, has also failed us. We don't mean to be ungrateful for the many marvels that medicine has bestowed upon us, nor do we mean to pile on or to point out the avalanche of obvious flaws and perverse incentives, but, well, it's just so easy.
Doctors do something for decades. It's widely done. It's widely believed to be beneficial. And then one day, a very seminal study contradicts that practice.
That's Vinay Prasad. He's an oncologist and an assistant professor of medicine at Oregon Health and Science University. He also co-authored a book about what are called medical reversals, when an established treatment is overturned, which happens how often?
It's widespread, and it's resoundingly contradicted. It isn't just that it had side effects we didn't think about. It was that the benefits that we had postulated turned out to be not true or not present.
How can it be that so many smart, motivated people, physicians and medical researchers, come up with so many treatments that go all the way through the approval process and then turn out to be ineffective or even harmful? A lot of it simply comes down to the incentives.
So much of the research agenda, even the randomized trial research agenda, is driven by the biopharmaceutical industry. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think there's many good things about that. That really drives many, many trials. It drives a lot of good products. It also drives a lot of marginal products or products that don't work. And the people who design those trials are, I think, very clever. You can sort of tilt the playing field a little bit to favor your drug, and the incentive to do so is often tremendous. Billions of dollars hinge on one of these pivotal trials. And to some degree, that's because it's a human pursuit. But to some degree, we could have policy changes that could more align the medical research agenda with what really matters to patients and doctors.
Let me ask you, in your own field, in oncology and in the particular cancers that you treat, how much more effective generally would you say the new cancer drugs are than the ones that they are replacing or augmenting?
Let me say that there are a few cancer drugs that have come out in the last two decades that are really wonderful drugs, great drugs. One drug came out of work here in the Oregon Health and Science University by Dr. Druker, Gleevec, and that's a drug that transformed a condition where maybe 50 or 60% of people are alive at 3 years to one where people more or less have a normal life expectancy. So that's a really wonderful drug. But I think if we're honest with ourselves, we'll have to admit that the majority of new cancer drugs are marginal, that they offer sort of very small gains at tremendous prices. And to give you an example of that, among 71 drugs approved for the solid cancers, the median improvement in overall survival, or how long people lived, was just 2.1 months. And those drugs routinely cost over $100,000 per year of treatment or course of treatment.
But that points to one of the tricks that works so well, which is if it's 2.1 months extra, and if the expected lifespan was, let's just pretend for a moment, it was 6 months, then on a percentage basis, that's a massive improvement. And so I don't, as the patient or as the pharma representative, I'm not talking about that length of time, which might be lived under physical duress and financial duress, but rather I'm thinking about, goodness gracious, a huge 33% life expectancy extension.
Right. A new drug improves lifespan 33% longer.
And who doesn't want that, especially when you're sitting there with your loved one in a horrible situation facing the end?
The other thing I'd point out is those 2.1 months, these clinical trials that are often conducted by the biopharmaceutical industry, they really choose sort of the healthiest patients, the people who are the fittest of the patients. On average, the age is almost 10 years younger in pivotal trials for the FDA drug approval than in the real world. And then when you start to extrapolate drugs that have real side effects in very carefully selected and small benefits in carefully selected populations to the average patient that walks into my clinic who's older, who has other problems, who's taking heart medicine. There was a paper that came out about one of those costly, expensive drugs for liver cancer. And in the pivotal trial, it had a benefit of about 2-3 months, something like that. But in the real world, in a Medicare data set, it had no improvement in survival over just giving somebody good nursing care and good supportive care. And I think that's the reality for many of these marginal drugs, that when you actually use them in the real world, they start to not work so well and maybe not work at all.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
You've written and spoken out about cronyism and conflicts of interest between drug makers and the doctors who prescribe drugs. I'm curious, what happens when you go to an oncology conference? Are you an unpopular person there?
Steve, and I always wear a bulletproof vest when I go to the... No, I'm just...
That, again, is Vinay Prasad.
But this has really been sort of the way medicine has operated for many years, that to some degree, practicing doctors in the community having ties to the drug makers, that's one thing. But increasingly, we see that the leaders in the field, the ones who design the clinical trials, who write up the manuscripts, who write the review articles, who sort of guide everyone on how to practice in those fields, they have heavy financial ties to drug makers. And there's a large body of evidence suggesting that that biases the literature towards finding benefits where benefits may not exist, towards more favorable cost-effective analyses when drugs are really probably not cost-effective. It's a bias.
Yes, well, we have a great deal of empirical data showing that funding sources and author financial conflicts of interest are associated with over-optimistic data.
That's Lisa Barrow. She's a professor of medicine. She's also co-chair of the Cochrane Collaboration, which is a global consortium of medical professionals and statisticians. Cochrane promotes evidence-based medicine by performing systematic reviews of medical research.
And in fact, we have a Cochrane review on this very question. And this finding shows that if a drug study is funded by a pharmaceutical company whose drug is being examined, they're much more likely to find that the drug is effective or safe.
How much more likely?
It's about 30%.
Did you catch that? An industry-funded study is 30% more likely to find the drug is effective and safe than a study with non-industry funding.
And they're likely to find this even if they control for other biases in the study. So by that, what I mean, it could be a really well-done study. It could be randomized. It could be blinded. But if it's industry funded, it's still more likely to find that the drug works.
But if a study is well done, how can the results be so skewed?
So it's everything from, I mean, the question they're actually asking to how they frame the question, the comparators they used, how they design the study, how it's conducted behind the scenes.
Trials are very often flawed by design in such a way that they're no longer the gold standard, no longer a fair test of which treatment is best.
That's Ben Goldacre.
I'm an academic in Oxford working in evidence-based medicine, and I also write books about how people misuse statistics.
So a lot of drugs that look great on paper don't do very well in the real world. Why? Part of it is what Ben Goldacre and Vinay Prasad were talking about, cherry-picking subjects for clinical trials. But Goldacre says there are plenty of other ways to manipulate trial numbers in the drug maker's favor. What do you do, for instance, when research subjects quit a trial because of the treatment side effects?
And what you see is people inappropriately using a statistical technique like last observation carried forward to account for missing data from patients who dropped out of a study because of side effects.
Last observation carried forward is a statistical extrapolation, pretty much what it sounds like, and worth looking up if you're interested in that kind of thing. You can see how an inappropriate use of such a technique would tilt things in the drug maker's favor. There's also the widespread use of what are called surrogate outcomes as opposed to real-world outcomes. Consider many of the drugs recently approved by the FDA to treat diabetes.
All of those drugs have been approved onto the market with only evidence showing that they improve your blood sugar. But none of them have got evidence showing that they reduce your risk of a heart attack or renal failure or eye problems or any of the actual real stuff that patients with diabetes care about.
Since all of those outcomes would be hard to test for in a clinical trial, and by hard, what I really mean is time-consuming and expensive, instead, the researchers go for the simple surrogate outcome of whether their pill lowers blood sugar.
But actually, it's not correlated as well as you might hope, and the history of medicine is absolutely littered with examples of where we have been given false reassurance by a treatment having a good impact on a surrogate outcome, a laboratory measure, and then discovered that actually it had completely the opposite effect on real-world outcomes.
as in the case of the infamous CAS trial that we covered in part one of the series, in which the drug that suppressed aberrant heart rhythms actually worsened survival outcomes. Now, we should point out that Ben Goldacre, and everyone we've been speaking with for our Bad Medicine episodes, fully appreciates that medicine is science and that failure is part of science. The human body is an extremely complex organism with lots to go wrong. Diagnosing and treating even a simple problem can be very difficult. So it's easy to take pot shots from the sideline at good ideas that went bad. It's even easier to criticize pharmaceutical companies who seem much more intent on making money than on making good medicines. But as Goldacre points out, those companies are simply responding to the incentives that are placed before them. Incentives that don't necessarily encourage them to do the right thing. Goldacre points to a massive 8-year study called the All-Hat Trial, in which academic researchers compared various drugs from a number of drug makers that were intended to lower blood pressure and cholesterol. Two of these drugs were made by the American pharmaceutical company Pfizer.
Pfizer came along and they said, look, we've got this fantastic new blood pressure lowering drug, and we've got various grounds for believing that it's going to be better than old-fashioned blood pressure lowering drugs. But at the moment, all we can tell you is it's roughly as good at lowering blood pressure.
So Pfizer asked the All Hat researchers to test whether their drug actually reduced the real-world outcomes that really matter: heart attack, stroke, and death.
So the researchers said what all academic researchers have said to drug companies since the dawn of time, which was, thank you very much, that sounds like a fabulous idea. That'll be about $175 million, please.
Actually, Goldacre misspoke. It was only $125 million, and Pfizer's share was just $40 million, but still, $40 million. So Pfizer pays in, and the trial begins.
It was timetabled to run for a very, very long time, many, many, many years. But it was stopped early because the Pfizer treatment, which was just as good at lowering blood pressure, was so much worse at preventing heart attack, stroke, and death that it was regarded as unethical to continue exposing patients to it.
The Pfizer drug we're talking about was called Cardura. So where does Pfizer come out in all this?
It's really important, I think, to recognize that Pfizer did nothing wrong here. Pfizer did exactly what we would hope all companies should do. They didn't just say, oh, well, that's fine, we've got some surrogate endpoint data, we've got laboratory data showing it lowers blood pressure and that's all we need. Instead, they went out and they did the right thing. They exposed themselves to a fair test. They said, we want to see if this treatment improves real-world outcomes that matter to patients: heart attack, stroke, and death. And they were unlucky, and it flopped.
The real problem, Goldacre says, is when drugs aren't subjected to the real-world test.
The real bad guys here are the people who continue to accept weak surrogate endpoint data, like, for example, on the new diabetes drugs. It may well be that they lower the laboratory measurement on a blood test, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they reduce your risk of heart attack, stroke, and death. And to find that out, we need to do proper randomized trials, which are admittedly longer and more expensive.
But there's yet another problem. What happens if a proper randomized trial doesn't show the efficacy a drug maker was hoping to show? Well, there's a good chance the world will never know about it because of
publication bias.
Ian Chalmers, a co-founder of the Cochrane Collaboration, is a major player in the evidence-based medicine movement.
About half of the clinical trials that are done never see the light of day. They don't get published. Isn't that outrageous?
Which trials do get published?
Trials that show results that are so-called statistically significant are more likely to get published than those that don't have those results.
Now, you might think, well, yes, it makes sense to publish trials where a medicine seems to work. And if it doesn't seem to work, why is that important to publish? Ben Goldacre again.
So if you cherry pick the results, if you only publish or promote the results of trials which show your favored treatment in a good light, then you can exaggerate the apparent benefits of that treatment.
As Chalmers tells us, there are all kinds of reasons why the results of an unsuccessful trial might not get published.
It may threaten commercial enterprises' interests to publish a trial which is disappointing. It may be something which someone who has had a favorite hypothesis and been known for writing and speaking about it for years finds out that the first really good study to test the hypothesis doesn't find any support for it. There's laziness.
And that's the real scandal here, is that you are allowed to legally withhold the results of these trials. And so people do. So the results of trials are routinely and legally withheld from doctors, researchers, and patients, the people who need this information the most. That is a systematic structural failure.
The structure, that is, imposed by government regulators, by funding sources, by the markets themselves, all of which can be very hard to change. So how does Ben Goldacre see the situation improving?
We set up something called the All Trials Campaign a couple of years ago. And the All Trials Campaign is a global campaign to try and stop this problem from happening. So asking companies, research institutes, academic and medical professional bodies, patient groups, and all of the rest to sign up and to say all trials should be registered. So you publicly post on a publicly accessible register the fact that you've started a trial, because that means we know which trials are happening. So at least we can see if some of them aren't being published.
The All Trials Campaign also urges the publication of what's called a clinical study report.
And a clinical study report is a very long, very detailed document, hundreds, sometimes thousands of pages long, that describes in great detail the design of the study and the results of the study. And that's really important because often a trial can be flawed by design in a way that is sufficiently technical that it is glossed over in the brief report that you get in an academic journal article about a trial. And those design flaws can only be seen in the full-length clinical study report.
There's also a growing momentum to curb conflicts of interest in medical research.
Well, I think we've already had great improvements in transparency. And what's really pushed the disclosure of funding sources has been the journals.
That's Lisa Barrow again from the Cochrane Collaboration.
So if you publish something, you are required to disclose the funding source. And, you know, this is still not 100% enforced, but it's getting pretty close.
On the other hand, Barrow says, a given researcher or investigator may have undisclosed biases or conflicts of interest.
And one sort of loophole is that the investigator themselves has to decide if something's relevant to the particular study. And so they may say, well, I just don't think it's relevant.
There's another quirk in the medical industry that probably doesn't serve the public good.
Drug companies evaluate their own products, whereas in software, you usually get somebody external to check the quality of your project. Engineers get people to do the earthquake checks for them, who are independent from the people who built the bridge. So it's a very odd system that we have, where the companies with an interest or stand to gain financially from testing a product are testing it themselves. So I think we need to change that.
And finally, there are the doctors themselves, the endpoint in this complicated, conflicted infrastructure that's meant to deliver better medicine. Ben Goldacre, the gadfly physician who knows so much about bad pharma and bad medicine, acknowledges that the entire system is due for reform.
And it's a structural failure that persists because of inaction by regulators, by policymakers, by doctors and researchers, as much as because of industry. And none of us can let ourselves off the hook.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, what's a doctor to do?
I see the opioid story as part of the recurring sense of hope and despair associated with these drugs that are supposed to solve problems, but they end up being problems in themselves.
What to do about the troubling finding that more experienced doctors have worse outcomes than young doctors? So I would think that you are a downright danger to your patients. How is it that you're not?
No comment.
And finally, yes, finally, lots of reasons to be optimistic, at least cautiously so, about the future of medicine.
Where science and medicine is going in the future is to more and more precision medicine so that we can get closer to an autonomous and individualized diagnosis.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio with your host, Stephen Dubner.
This is an American condition. This is an American disease. This has been one of the great mistakes of modern medicine.
That's David Kessler, who ran the Food and Drug Administration during the 1990s. Surely you know the condition, the disease he's talking about. President Obama discussed it.
This crisis is taking lives. It's destroying families. It's shattering communities all across the country.
But what does Kessler mean when he says this has been one of the great mistakes of modern medicine?
Drug overdoses now take more lives every year than traffic accidents. A lot of time, they're from legal drugs prescribed by a doctor.
What Kessler is talking about is a combination of good intentions, greed, and a complicated changing relationship between doctors and their patients. The result? People dying every year from prescription drugs that are supposed to heal us, not kill us. It's a sick twist, isn't it? So how'd this happen?
It's part of the recurring sense of hope and despair associated with these drugs that are supposed to solve problems, but they end up being problems in themselves.
The numbers are remarkable.
Prescription opioid use has gone up about 300 to 400%. Since the year 2000.
It's because we are a consumer society that believes in the power of a magic pill.
How did medicine get taken over by consumerism?
Doctors used to practice medicine on sick and injured patients, and it was those two players in the healthcare system. And now the same two people in the room, the doctor and the patient, behind the room is a gigantic industry of people buying, selling, trading, bartering, discounting, marking up all of our services.
And what's one of the main reasons any of us might go to a doctor? It's easy. It's because we're in pain. In the late 1980s and early 90s, there was a push to mandate the recognition and treatment of pain. This culminated in the promotion of pain as the fifth vital sign, along with temperature, blood pressure, pulse, and respiratory rate, which made pain the only vital sign that is determined not by objective measurement, but by the patient's own assessment. So doctors were put in the position of having to determine whose pain was worthy of a prescription painkiller and whose wasn't. Very often, doctors have decided yes. In 2015, more than 650,000 opioid prescriptions were dispensed per day in the U.S., One result of this prescription onslaught, it is believed to have contributed to a recent uptick in mortality rates. Anupam Jena is a physician and a healthcare economist at Harvard.
Mortality rates in the U.S. have risen for the first time in 10 years.
Which is striking, considering that mortality rates have been falling for at least 100 years. The U.S. rise has been concentrated among a few groups, particularly white, middle-aged men and women. Among white men with a high school education or less, the death rate has risen an astonishing 22%.
And the attribution of these issues is in part due to opioids. And this is a problem that was created by medicine.
And yet you certainly can't blame your profession for that because it's an effective drug when used well, correct?
Correct, yeah. And, you know, like many drugs in medicine, they're effective in certain situations. So for patients who fall at home and break their hip and have a hip fracture, opioids for situations like that are known to be effective pain relievers. Or in patients with cancer, particularly in cancer with bone pain because of disease that has metastasized to the bone, opioids in that situation have been shown to be highly effective in terms of reducing pain. But opioids for low back pain or headaches or knee pain or hip pain or just chronic pain in general, opioids are not thought to be an effective strategy, and yet we've seen the proliferation of their use in the last decade.
So, how do you maximize the use of opioids when appropriate and minimize their overuse? That's not easy. There are a lot of confounding factors, but it's hard to come up with good prescribing protocols for pain relievers when you don't even have good measurement for pain. Keith Whalew is a Princeton historian who focuses on health policy.
Because we don't have any objective measures for actually figuring out what works, we are necessarily in a realm where not just subjective assessment, but also trial and error medicine is necessary to figure out what works.
And to that end, Whalew says,
we need to think about over-medication and under-medication as not two poles of the use of pain medicine, because then what we do is we kind of just whiplash like a pendulum. We go from believing that under-medication is a problem to believing that over-medication is a problem. What we need to do is to understand that both of these things can be a problem at the same time.
The American Medical Association, hoping to address this problem, recently turned back the clock. It recommended that pain be removed as a fifth vital sign. But how much will that help? Anupam Jena again.
As an economist, I think about supply and demand. So there's the demand of patients, increasing demand for patients, by patients for opioids.
Once you've put the power in the hands of the patient, or just to call it what it is, in the hands of the consumer, it can be hard to reclaim it. So how do we get here?
Yeah, so pain management was really emerging as a recognizable and legitimate area of medical practice and care in the 1960s, early 1970s, with the development of multidisciplinary pain centers.
Keith Whalew again.
There was a general recognition that you needed more than just drugs to deal with people in chronic pain. You needed social workers, you needed surgeons, you needed psychologists, you needed a wide range of others, as well as people with pharmacological expertise.
But those multidisciplinary pain centers really expensive.
And so, you know, one of the economic trends since the 1980s with the rise of cost containment is to sort of see drugs as the cheapest and the fastest solution to our problem.
This coincided with a big shift in how drugs are marketed to the public.
Before the 1980s, the idea that you would see prescription drugs being advertised on television was laughable. It emerges in the mid-1980s that, you know, we're sort of seeing government regulation as the problem and the market as the solution to our problems.
Zoloft prescription medicine can help.
With Advair?
Crestor.
Cymbalta?
And out of this era emerges this idea that people have the right to have the information at their disposal.
Increased risk of prostate cancer, worsening prostate symptoms, decreased sperm count, ankle, feet, or body swelling, enlarged or painful breasts.
About prescription drugs, and to bring that knowledge into the physician's office.
Ask your doctor.
That's between you and your doctor.
Talk with
you. In order to not so much demand, but to shape clinical decision making.
Ask your doctor. Ask your doctor.
Ask your doctor.
Call your doctor right away.
In fact, the aggressive marketing of OxyContin as a safe pain medication led to criminal convictions for top executives at its manufacturer, Purdue Pharma, for misleading the FDA, clinicians, and patients about its risks. But just because one painkiller is declared risky doesn't mean that consumers wouldn't demand other painkillers. And once consumers gained more leverage in the medical realm, guess whose opinions began to matter a lot more? Yep, the consumers, in the form of those patient satisfaction surveys you fill out after a doctor's visit.
Yeah, it is a problem. You know, that's the problem when we just measure things that are easy to measure.
That's Marty McCary, a surgical director and health policy scholar at Johns Hopkins.
By putting all this attention on customer satisfaction, or consumer satisfaction, or patient satisfaction, we're creating a consumerist culture in healthcare. People come in, they want an antibiotic for their kid, and they don't care what your diagnosis or explanation is. They want to walk out with that antibiotic prescription. Or you're in pain and you want that pain script. If the doctor is under the microscope for their patient satisfaction scores, you can imagine the perverse incentive here.
Indeed. A 2012 paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association pointed to an unintended consequence of this perverse incentive. Physicians who do not comply with patient requests, the authors wrote, may be the recipients of poor ratings on patient satisfaction scores, possibly resulting in emotional, financial, and professional penalties. So, imagine this. You are a doctor and your patient asks, maybe by name, for a prescription painkiller. You may think the patient doesn't really need it. You may, in fact, be worried they'll abuse it, maybe even sell it. But if that consumer has the ability to punish you professionally, well, you might just write the script.
They respond to demands. They cope with their job by, you know, giving an angry patient what they want, not what they need, because they have to see five patients in an hour. I can tell you emphatically, doctors are getting crushed out there. They're getting crushed with record rates of burnout due to increasing overhead, higher malpractice premiums, declining pay, lowering Medicare reimbursement, being forced to see more patients in a single hour, corporate medicine.
On top of all that, McCary says, there is a brutal paradox. Patient satisfaction is not a helpful metric when it comes to measuring health outcomes. Well, at least not helpful in the direction you might think it would be. A 2012 study found that the most satisfied patients had higher rates of hospitalization and higher mortality rates. Why? The authors suggest that more satisfied patients may request more discretionary treatments, which may increase the likelihood of adverse effects.
So, you know, it's a big problem. You know, what's important to a patient when they come to a doctor? The doctor's patient satisfaction score? Well, that's a piece of the doctor's quality. But really, what you're interested in is the doctor's judgment and the doctor's skill and the doctor's ability to empathize.
Those are the sort of metrics, Marty McCary argues, that will help doctors treat patients better. So coming up on Freakonomics Radio, now all you've got to do is collect all the data on doctors' judgment, skill, and empathy, right? But again, not so easy, in part because of the sheer volume of that data.
We are doing more than we've ever done before. We are doing more procedures, more giving more medications, hospitalizing more patients, diagnosing more things than we ever have in the history of medicine.
Also, why feedback for doctors is so important, especially for doctors who've been practicing a while.
What we find is that if you happen to be treated by a doctor who is 10 years or 15 years out of residency, your mortality within 30 days of being hospitalized is higher.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Marty McCary, the surgeon and health policy scholar we've been speaking with, is a big advocate for medical reform. First step, improving the feedback loop. That is, what we know, and way too often what we don't know, about what actually works.
I think the number one problem is we don't measure performance. We don't measure the outcomes of patients in healthcare for 99% of the healthcare that's delivered.
McCary might be exaggerating a bit, but still, how can this be? When you go in for medical treatment, don't the health professionals who treat you find out if their intervention actually worked? The short answer is often no. But the longer answer is much worse. The longer answer is that not only do medical interventions often not work, medical interventions will sometimes kill you. Marty McCary and co-author Michael Daniel recently published a study arguing that the third leading cause of death in the U.S. after heart disease and cancer was medical error. I'm going to say that again. The third leading cause of death in the U.S., accounting for 10% of deaths annually, is medical error. How can this be? Are doctors and nurses showing up for work stoned out of their skulls? Are they sneaking into hospital rooms at night and smothering their most annoying patients? Are they surreptitiously removing healthy organs to sell them on the black market? If only. That would make the problem so much easier to solve. Why are so many deaths the result of medical error?
Well, I think anybody that practices medicine knows that medical errors are a function of the amount of things that we do in healthcare.
The amount of things meaning what?
We are doing more than we've ever done before. We are doing more procedures, more giving more medications, hospitalizing more patients, diagnosing more things than we ever have in the history of medicine. Right here today in the United States, we have the most medicalized, the most diagnosed population in the history of the world.
In economic terms, you could say there's both an oversupply and an overdemand of healthcare, since the supply and demand are both fueled by the setup of our healthcare insurance system. Patients who buy expensive insurance want to get their money's worth and may overconsume, just as you might overconsume at an all-you-can-eat restaurant. And doctors who make money primarily when they do stuff may tend to do more stuff.
When we're doing all of this stuff, it makes you wonder, does that mean we're also making mistakes proportional to the amount of stuff that we do?
Well, that sounds scary.
So first of all, I don't want to scare people out there. Most doctors are doing the right thing and always will.
All right, but how can it be that the people we entrust to heal us, the people who've worked their entire adult lives to learn how to heal us, may sometimes be killing us? To get to that answer, you first have to understand that for decades, we've been making a sort of clerical error.
Our research found the methodological flaw in our country's national health statistics. We use a billing code system to tally causes of death from death certificates. And people don't just die from billing codes. They die from medical mistakes, communication breakdowns, overdoses, fragmented care, closed insurance networks, preventable complications, unnecessary treatments. And if you look collectively at this group of problems, let me call it medical care gone wrong, it's got a significant burden in society.
But those complications and oversights and errors, McCary says, seldom wind up on the death certificate.
When you fill out the death certificate, you have to list the reason the patient died, both the direct reason and the underlying reason the patient died. Well, we all knew what the real reason was, but you can't put that on somebody's death certificate.
Why not?
When somebody experiences a fatal mistake, their heart stops, and then you do CPR, then you pronounce them dead. What do you put on the death certificate when it says, what was the cause of the patient's immediate death? And that's really what got us thinking, and that's what led to this study. Because, you know, you end up putting cardiovascular arrest. And then it turns out what we put on the death certificates populates our country's national health statistics. So when the government puts out every year, these are the most common causes of death in the United States. And by the way, that list is a big deal. That list informs all of our research funding. It informs all of our public health campaigns in America. That list is a big deal. So, you know, you realize we're misclassifying medical mistakes as other causes and that medical mistakes don't even show up on the list.
So McCary and his colleagues got hold of a mountain of data and started digging.
Well, we basically looked at the best available research on the topic from the New England Journal of Medicine and Health Affairs and a big Medicare analysis and something called the OIG report. It was a government report that was independent.
And what'd they find? Before I tell you that, let me tell you this. There is a famous report put out by the Institute of Medicine in 1999 that set a benchmark for death by medical error. That report estimated there were between 44,000 and 98,000 deaths annually in the U.S. due to medical error. Those are obviously large and frightening numbers, so large and frightening that I've heard many, many medical professionals insist those numbers had to be way too high. So what number did McCary come up with? At least 250,000 deaths every year in the U.S. due to medical error. A quarter of a million people. Before we get into the errors themselves, let's think for just a minute about how the story of those deaths was hidden in the data. As we've noted throughout these episodes on bad medicine, A lot of what we take as factual and empirical within medicine often isn't very empirical. That includes how data from clinical trials are manipulated or misinterpreted. And, as Marty Makary argues, it includes how the cause of death is categorized. And that's why he's pushing for a fundamental reform to require that doctors, when they fill out a death certificate, specifically indicate if a medical error was involved. Because how do you solve a problem if you don't even acknowledge the problem? And with medical errors, the problem is both deep and broad.
Now, medical errors have a complex taxonomy.
That, again, is the Harvard doctor and economist Anupam Jena.
But for someone like me, I would just break them into two categories. There are errors of diagnosis, and then there's errors of commission, when a patient has surgery on the wrong leg, or when a patient is given an antibiotic despite it being well documented in the medical record that he or she has an allergy to that medication, or when a patient receives a dose of insulin that is 5 times as much what it should have been because someone couldn't read a doctor's handwriting in the chart. There are errors that occur in the hospital because of poor hygiene and infectious disease management where people get hospital-acquired infections.
I've got to think that those errors of commission are extraordinarily rare, though, yes?
Well, you would hope so, but it turns out that they're not. The Johns Hopkins study is actually more about those second set of errors.
The problem is a system problem.
That's Marty Makary again. Makary himself is a surgeon.
99% of people that have surgery in the United States go home and no one documents or keeps track at a systematic level, that is national or regional or hospital level, how the patient does. At 6 months, are you glad that you had your knee surgery done? At 6 months after hip surgery, are you walking again? Or a year after weight loss surgery, what is your weight today? We don't keep track of those things in healthcare for most of the procedures or treatments that we do. And the problem is that how can you really come up with a quality metric if nobody's tracking it?
This doesn't mean doctors never check in with their patients, but the system simply isn't designed to capture robust follow-up data.
Well, there's a follow-up visit. You know, we'll scribble some note, patient's doing well, incision has healed nicely. Who's actually measuring the real patient-centered outcomes 6 months later or a year later? That is a giant opportunity in healthcare to fix the system by creating a marketplace centered around value, not just around quantity.
That, of course, would require incentives for doctors that reward preventive care and maintenance rather than just interventions. But absent good follow-up data and absent good feedback in general, it's hard to tell what works and what doesn't. Of course, this is true for anything, not just medicine. But with medicine, the stakes are high. And if you're the patient, the stakes are practically infinite. You are putting your life in someone's care, and you only have one life, as far as we know. Other choices might seem hard, like which house to buy, how to invest your money, how to pick a career or a college major. But if you've got a serious health concern, your choice of treatment and doctor is an existential choice. So given a choice between two doctors, let's say, one fresh out of medical school and the other with 15 years experience, which one do you go for? Just to be clear, if you happen to draw a more experienced doctor, you are more likely to die.
And so it does suggest that more experience actually could have a negative effect on outcomes.
That, again, is the Harvard doctor and economist Anupam Jena. And what's your best explanation for why that's the case?
So I think the most likely explanation is two things. One is that the field of medicine is constantly evolving, and there's always new knowledge, new evidence emerging, both in terms of how to make better diagnoses and what are the right treatments for particular patients. And as you get further and further away from residency, I think what happens is that the knowledge that you had that you as a resident, which time when you spend 80 to 100 hours per week in the hospital, that knowledge gets somewhat ingrained in you. New knowledge isn't picked up as rapidly. So I think what happens is that older physicians are just less up to date, if you will. I'll give you one caveat. We don't see this effect among high volume doctors, doctors who are seeing a lot of patients. And so what that suggests is that if you're an older doctor who is seeing a lot of patients, you are protected from this adverse effect, which makes sense.
Unfortunately, some people come out of medical school or training thinking, all right, I've mastered this body of knowledge or this skill set, and I'm good to go for the next 50 years of practice.
Marty McCary again.
And the reality is, even as a tenured faculty at Johns Hopkins doing complex surgery in a group that does, you know, the four of us do the most pancreatic surgery of any group in the country, I'm still learning every day. And my senior partner, who's about to retire, he's still learning, you know, the year before he stops operating every day. So medicine's a career of learning. And I think the more feedback we can get at any level.
That said, Anupam Jena's research shows that surgeons are among the subset of physicians who do seem to improve with experience.
There's the thought that muscle skill experience in the surgical field over time improves outcomes, and we find that as well. But outside of surgery, when you're thinking about the care of patients that requires a lot of cognitive skill and being up to date on current medications and diagnoses, we actually find that over time, older doctors do worse.
So someone like you, so I don't mean to turn this into attack on you, but someone like you who, medical school is getting further in the rearview mirror as it is for every doctor, but additionally, you're only practicing for a couple of months out of the year, not full time. So I would think that you are a downright danger to your patients. How is it that you're not?
No comment. Well, you know, so usually when I work on service, I'm paired with someone who is a full-time clinician educator, and there's a huge difference in the amount of knowledge, and it's very humbling to see that.
Jena's research looks specifically at physician experience as it relates to patient outcomes, but there's another angle to consider when we talk about experience in the medical realm, especially if you're interested in reform. We have supposedly entered the era of evidence-based medicine. This is still relatively new ground.
The reality was that what we were practicing was something called eminence-based medicine.
That's the physician and researcher Vinay Prasad.
It was where the preponderance of medical practice was driven by really charismatic and thoughtful, probably to some degree, leaders in medicine. And, you know, medical practice was based on bits and scraps of evidence, anecdotes, bias, preconceived notions, and probably a lot of, you know, psychological traps.
As outdated as that sounds now, keep in mind that a lot of our institutions, including medical institutions, are still eminence-based, which is to say, in many institutions, many big decisions are made by the highest-ranking people who tend to have the most experience. And people with a lot of experience tend to have fixed views on things. They're attracted to the status quo or some minor variation of it because that's what they know. It's what they trust and believe in. Also, if you want to be a bit uncharitable for a moment, we might argue that the status quo is additionally appealing to senior people because they got theirs already. They've got their job, their status, their salary, and all that disruption that reformers like to talk about. It's messy. It's time-consuming. It's a pain in the neck. Like I said, that isn't a charitable view, but I'm afraid it's not wrong either. Change can be hard. Uncertainty can be scary. True improvement can be elusive. But one thing that's so inspiring about all the people we've been speaking with for this series is how they embrace the notion that it's okay to challenge the very institution that you've devoted your career to. In fact, with medicine, it's a requirement. I think back to something we heard from Philip Makoviak, the doctor who unraveled the true story of 98.6.
As a medical historian, it is patently obvious to me that future generations will look at what we're doing today and ask themselves, what was Grandpa thinking of when he did that and believed that? Look at us now, how good we are. Why weren't they that good? And they'll have to learn all over again that science is imperfect. And to maintain a healthy skepticism about everything we believe and do in life in general, but in the medical profession in particular.
So what happens now? There's a long list and reasons to be excited. But given the complexities of medicine, McCary warns, we shouldn't expect quick fixes.
First of all, it's different. In every area of medicine, it's different. If you're a cardiologist or an OB or a psychiatrist, you can't simply implement strategies to improve quality and standardized care in the same way. In my own field of surgery, we believe there's something that can be done called benchmarking. That is, we can see how we stand as a surgical group, as individual surgeons, relative to other surgeons in our region and nationally that take on similarly complex cases. And that's why we've proposed, and we have a grant to do this nationally, we want the doctors' associations to come up with a metric of performance. We want to apply it to all the doctors in that specialty. And then we want to just share the data with the doctors individually in a confidential, peer-to-peer, civil fashion. This is where you stand. This is where the rest of the country stands. And we're not making a judgment. We just want to share with you your data.
The point, McCary says, is improvement, not punishment.
As a matter of fact, firing people for making mistakes in hospitals is the absolute wrong approach. We need to learn from our mistakes, not send a message that if you have a concern or speak up or you do a mistake, we're going to kick you out.
Doctors are already in a tough place, under attack from nearly every quarter, including, for these past few episodes, Freakonomics Radio. And the fear of making a mistake, or what may be construed as a mistake, is already so high that doctors practice way too much defensive medicine, that is, tests and procedures primarily meant to avoid a malpractice suit. A 2010 study found that U.S. hospitals and doctors spent about $45 billion a year on defensive medicine. But if the present looks occasionally bleak, the good news is there's plenty of optimism about the future of medicine.
Where science and medicine is going in the future is to more and more precision medicine so that we can get closer to an autonomous and individualized diagnosis.
That's Teresa Woodruff, a professor at Northwestern and director of the Women's Health Research Institute.
Science is becoming even more catalytic, so it's going faster and faster and faster. Breakthroughs are coming about every day. And I suspect within the next 10 to 15 years, we'll really understand enough to get away from radiation and chemotherapy. And that eventuality is the promise of basic science and medicine.
I think the game is going to be the same game, which is a game where, if we're really honest, perhaps a lot of the low-hanging fruit in medicine has been plucked, some of the great interventions.
And that, again, is Vinay Prasad.
Now it's a matter of sorting out interventions with medium to small benefits, but that's okay. But with a medium and a small benefit, you really have to be sure that you can minimize bias. You can minimize the role of your own sort of preconceived notions, and that's why we need careful randomized studies.
But the biggest reason for optimism, Prasad argues, doesn't have to do with better evidence or better protocols or better medicine, per se. Has to do with better thinking. And that, he says, is happening.
I see it every day in medicine. I see it in movements like the British Medical Journal's really commitment to evidence, to transparency, to data sharing. I see it in JAMA Internal Medicine's commitment to knowing when more is harmful, when too much medicine is harmful, and that took many years for us to realize. I think we, you know, are increasingly allowing people with diverse points of view in medicine, contrarians, perhaps even like myself, to write articles in really important journals so that they can be read and thought of by other people. So I think we're at a moment where, you know, we're much more open to different ideas on how to move medicine forward.
So here's to moving forward. I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week. If you just can't wait that long, you can get our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at Freakonomics.com or at iTunes, where you can also subscribe.